trucking on. And I'm trucking on. Move her on down the line, another town will do me fine. I'm trucking on. I'm trucking on.
Howdy, friends, and welcome to Trucking On. I'm your host, Ward Richmond. I really appreciate you tuning in today, and I hope you enjoy the show. Randy Thompson.
Good morning, Mr. Richmond.
Welcome to Trucking On.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Thanks for being here. You're in my new studio.
I love it. It's beautiful.
So it's a little bit of a test run, so I'll see what Roy, my editor, has to say about all my new equipment.
It sounds good.
Thanks for being here on Trucking On.
Yeah, love it.
I've been talking to you about doing this podcast since I started the podcast.
For a while now, yeah.
And you're always like, no, nah, there's someone else at Ryan Companies, your company, right, that should do this. It's like, no, I want Randy to do this.
Oh, I appreciate it. I've been looking forward to this.
Yeah, you're one of the most interesting people I know.
Well, we'll see about that. We'll have about an hour to figure that out.
We will. We met when I worked at Cushman & Wakefield.
Yep.
And you ran construction management.
Project management, right.
Nationally.
Yes.
Right?
Eventually, yeah. I started in Dallas and then was moved into a regional position and then ultimately a national position. And then my last 10 years there, I was on essentially an international role supporting Unilever globally. And I was part of their national industrial leadership team at C&W, yeah.
Very cool. And let's get into this. I like to start by asking my guest, what happened in your life ages 12 to 22?
Yeah.
Highs, lows, things that had a big impact on your life.
There was a lot going on in those years for me. I was born and raised in Los Angeles, and my father was a piano tuner. I noticed your piano that you've got in the other room. That's what my dad did for a living.
I need him over here.
Well, that'd be a trick. He passed away about 5 years ago. Awesome. So. But my son, who you talked about maybe having on as well, learned to tune pianos from my father.
What's your son's name?
Jesse.
Jesse, okay.
Yeah. My dad wanted me to learn, and I tried some, especially when I was a teenager, but I didn't have the patience for it. It takes a lot of time to really get good at it. And so I'll update you, or I'll mention a little more about my dad here in just a second. But at 12, I would have been starting junior high school at Robert Fulton Junior High School in the San Fernando Valley, which is a suburb of Los Angeles. And by then, I'd learned to play the drums. And so I was playing in the junior high band. I actually played in the orchestra band as well. When I got there, I'd started learning to play the drums a year before I got to junior high school. So by the time I got there, I had my drumming basics down. When they said to play a rat-a-ma-cue and a paradiddle and a press roll, I knew what all those things were. So I was able to demonstrate that. So I got right into the upper level band, which was a great, great spot for me because it really, I was amongst musicians who were better than I was. So I was getting my musical chops kind of in place during that time. That would have been in 1974. Went through junior high school. Then after that, I went to Van Nuys High School. I played in the jazz band there as well. A couple of fun facts about my time at Van Nuys High School. I played football. I was an outside linebacker.
Okay.
And when I was a junior, I played against a future Heisman Trophy winner, a guy named Charles White, who went on to USC. In those days, San Fernando High School, which is where Charles went, was something of a feeder school for running backs to USC. They'd had a lot of them go through San Fernando. Charles was one of them. And as I tell the story, I saw the back of his jersey all day long. I mean, it was ridiculous how fast this guy was. So I'd be set in my position, and then there he went. And it was just like that the whole night long.
Did you ever get him?
Never.
No.
No, I didn't even get close.
Yeah.
But then the next year, my kind of football hall of claim to fame was we were playing Granada Hills High School, and they had a junior quarterback that everybody was kind of talking about. And he dropped back to pass, and I dropped into my zone, and he threw the ball my way, and I picked it off and got it back to about the three where I was tackled. And that was a kid named John Elway. So in my two years, I played against a future Heisman Trophy winner and a future Hall of Famer. So yeah, those were kind of heady days in my development of my sporting prowess.
That's pretty cool. You know, I went to Woodrow Wilson High School here.
Okay.
And we're known as the home of the Heisman.
Okay.
And we had Tim Brown and Davey O'Brien both played at Woodrow.
Oh, wow.
But not when I was there.
Okay.
So we went 0-10 my senior year. Oh, we did not have any Heisman Trophy winners.
Yeah.
But
we were 0-11 my junior year. And then we did make the playoffs my senior year.
So really?
We turned it around. Yeah, in 1 year, yeah.
Yeah, they got really good a couple years after I left. And but when I was there, Woodrow was a weird school because we had a huge dropout rate. So it was inner city urban schools. Okay. So our freshman class probably had like 600 people in it, and our senior class had like 200 people in it.
Oh my gosh.
And that weeds out a lot of the dropouts were football players. And then a lot of the football players also, they transferred to different football schools because it's Texas. So people's parents are like, no, you need to go here and you have a better chance of winning a state championship or something. And they start seeing the writing on the wall at Woodrow. So it was a tough senior year, but I had a great time and experience going to school there.
The other thing that I wanted to mention to you, I started to, was about my dad and the things that I learned from him as I was growing up.
Yeah.
My mom didn't work. She was a stay-at-home mom. So we were not wealthy by any stretch. But my dad was a very, very hard worker. He didn't graduate college. After he came back from World War II in the Navy, he went and apprenticed at a Steinway store in downtown Los Angeles. Mm-hmm. And he would go in at 3 a.m. and turn the lights on and have his tuning hammer and all those equipment. And he would practice tuning these pianos. He had a mentor that was helping him too, but he would practice tuning these pianos from 3 a.m. until the shop opened at 10. And the way he grew his business was when Mr. Komsky, who owned the store, when he would sell a piano, my dad's business card would go with the piano and he would be recommended as the tuner to keep the piano in tune. These are very high-end musical instruments. And so
Steinways are
absolutely
the best in class.
And so that's where my dad got started. And ultimately he wound up with a quite a successful small business just for a single entrepreneur, one guy, you know, tuning pianos. And I remember growing up Sunday nights at 6 o'clock, he would go into his office and make his phone calls and make his appointments for the week. And that would usually last until around 8:30 or 9. So I was watching him spending the time in order to get the appointments for the piano tuning that he would do throughout the week. He also was a piano teacher. So he would give lessons to students, and he'd converted our garage into what was a really very nice studio space. And he had his, I think it was a 7-foot Grotrian Steinway in there. It was a beautiful, beautiful concert piano that he couldn't afford, but he bought anyway, much to my mom's chagrin. But anyway, that's a whole other story. But anyway, so he would host recitals. So he would have students, they were required once a month to come and play at a recital where the parents would gather. And my job I was probably 10 or 12 at that point, was to set up the folding chairs. So I would set up the folding chairs in the garage, and then the kids would play. And then when it was over, I'd put the folding chairs away. Well, one evening after one of these performances, a gentleman, he had a thick beard and looked to be about as in his 40s, I would guess. But, you know, I'm cute. What do I know? But anyway, he went up and started talking to my dad, and he looked at the piano and they were chatting. And ultimately, my dad offered the seat to him. And so he sat down at the piano and started to play. And after a few minutes, he stopped. And then my dad and this guy talked a little bit more. And then he got up and handed my dad one of his business cards. And then he got up and left. Well, come to find out, I asked my dad about that afterwards, after I got everything done. The guy had said he was looking at a piano like the one that my dad had and wanted to try it to see, you know, how it felt. And so my dad said, of course, go ahead and sit down and play it. So he played it. And when he paused, he said, this guy looked at me and said, who's your tuner? I like the way this piano was set up and it sounds good. And my dad said, well, I tune it myself. And then he handed my dad his business card and said, you're now my tuner. And that guy was John Williams. This was just as he was getting ready to... John Williams. And the kid that my dad, that Mr. Williams was there to see, was his son who wound up going on to play with Toto. He was the keyboardist in the band Toto back in the 80s and 90s. So that was... My dad became kind of a piano tuner to the stars. He tuned for Julie Andrews. He tuned for Itzhak Perlman. He was actually at, Cary Grant's house on Mr. Grant's birthday, when a pink convertible Cadillac was delivered to the driveway. It was a present from Elvis Presley. That's the sort of stuff that my dad got to do. Not the circle that he ran in, because that was a very heady circle. But he was part of that that hierarchy, if you will. That he was known as the piano tuner to the stars in Los Angeles. And I watched him do that, and it was a real education for me in terms of somebody who's coming from nothing and really applying himself and becoming skilled enough that he was sought out. Sought out craftsmen for those pianos.
And it sounds like he just did it through hard work and tenacity. Work.
Absolutely.
And then he mastered a craft.
He had three kids he had to provide for. And he had that kind of work ethic. And it was not always, I mean, trust me, it was rough at times. I mean, Los Angeles in those days, it's a lot more expensive there now, obviously. But he wasn't making a lot of money. And I remember some of the stuff that we would do when kids, on a Sunday, for example, my mom and dad would take us over to Topanga Plaza, which was the first, of my knowledge, the first shopping mall in the greater Los Angeles area. It was out in the West San Fernando Valley. Mm-hmm. And they took us on Sundays because everything's closed. But we could walk the hallways and do window shopping and look at all the things that we would never be able to buy. And it was a way of getting us out and, you know, getting us to see what else was out there. And, you know, you work hard and eventually, you know, my dad got to the point where he was comfortable. But he worked all the way up until he could no longer hear, as a matter of fact. And just about 6 months before he died, Mr. Williams actually called him just to check in on him, see how he was doing.
Really?
So, yeah, they had that kind of friendship. Yeah.
That's so cool. Neat. So, you were a jack of all trades in high school.
Oh, yeah.
I assume pretty popular guy. Did you do student government or anything like that?
I didn't do student government, but what I did learn very early on is that it doesn't hurt to be a drummer. There's something of an aphrodisiac effect where a lot of young ladies in junior high and high school, when you're the drummer, and that continued on. I was playing with my son about 4 years ago down in Fredericksburg, and I played in a father-son band with him, two dads and our sons. And I'm now going past 22 years of age, so we can come back.
Yeah, we'll come back. I'll bring him back around.
Okay. I did okay. And during those years too, I learned how to surf. I learned how to water ski. I learned how to snow ski. I learned how to ride a unicycle. Going from high school into college, I learned how to throw the javelin. So yeah, I kept really busy, not only with music, but a lot of sports, outdoor activities and things like that. Hiking. I climbed up the back of Half Dome, for example, back in, I was probably 18 or 19 at the time that happened. I kept busy and I had a lot of, I was a popular guy. I had a lot of friends. I was very outgoing, still am. But it didn't hurt being the drummer and being an athlete as well.
Yeah, that's amazing. So then where did you go to college?
When I graduated from Van Nuys High School, again, we did not have a lot of money. So my pathway was through the junior college system. So I went from Van Nuys High School to Pierce Junior College, where I was for 2 years, where I learned to throw the javelin, played with the track team. I had some friends that were on the track team. And then from there, I went to Cal State Northridge, where I got my undergraduate degree. And then that would have been in 1982, I would have graduated from Cal State Northridge. And then I went back to school 10 years later and got my master's degree from USC.
Cool.
Yeah.
And then you got it. Did you do a fraternity or anything like
no,
that?
No, I didn't. I did
play in a band the whole time?
Yeah, I was in music the whole time. I did rush a fraternity at Cal State Northridge, but the Greek system in a university that's mostly a commuter school was really kind of half-assed, if you'll pardon the French. And I didn't particularly care for it. And I never ever actually got to the point where I got past the pledging. I dropped out during the pledge process.
Yeah.
It wasn't advancing what I was trying to do. And I was older than most of the guys. Many of them, you know, went straight from high school to 4-year college. I didn't. So, you know, I was waiting hand and foot on people who were 2 years younger than me, and it just didn't sit real well. So the payoff wasn't worth the investment. So I never went through the Greek system really fully.
And then what was your first job when you got out?
So I got out of school and I landed a job with a company called Boyd Corporation. I knew, you know, one of the things I wanted to share that will lead up to what I'm about to discuss, the people who influenced me when I was kind of in the formulating process. My dad was one. My other was my grandfather, Art. And Grandpa Art, when I was 12 to maybe 16, on weekends, he would take me out with him on Saturdays and he would pay me to do it. We would go out on Saturdays. He worked for an overhead door company, an industrial overhead door company. So I was walking job construction sites when I was just a young early teen. And we would go out on a Saturday and we would go through these big warehouses with 150, 200 door openings. And one by one, with a measuring tape and with a big pole that he would attach the end of the measuring tape to, we would measure the width of the given door and we would measure the height of it in both corners all the way around. So that he, and then he had this clipboard that he would precisely mark exactly how big the openings are because he wanted his doors to fit to perfection. And some of them were, you know, a quarter inch off here or a half inch off there. So he spent the time. And again, I learned a lot from him there. And one of the things that he told me over and over and over again when I was at a point in my life when it really had an influence on me was he said, Randy, the important thing to know about business is nothing happens until somebody sells something. And so I carried that around with me through high school and into college. And then when I graduated, I knew I was going to be a salesperson, an outside salesperson. Mm-hmm. And I didn't want to work at a desk. I wanted to get out and get where people are working and so on. So anyway, I wound up going to work for a small manufacturing company out of the city of industry called Boyd Corporation. And I didn't know the first thing about conveyor belts or silicone rubber gaskets or die stamp materials or any of that stuff. But I got a crash course in it. And I started to learn. And I was given a $1,500 salary a month, a company station wagon, a territory that ran from Burbank to Santa Barbara, and a pager. Back in those days, we didn't have cell phones. So I had a pager. And I thought, man, this was a technological wonder. I had a pager.
I had a pager my first job, too.
It was just amazing. So over the course of the next 6 months, I learned where there was where just about every payphone was that was safe to use from Burbank to Santa Barbara. Because when that pager went off, I had to find one of them quick. But I learned. And my first year, I did okay. My second year, I made $52,000, which in 1984 money was the equivalent of about $210 today.
Yeah.
So I was doing really well. I stayed there for a couple of years and realized that I was on a fairly short ladder. And there wasn't really much room for me to go beyond where I was. And I could probably continue to make that sort of money, but I wanted more out of a career than just that. So ultimately, I went from selling conveyor systems or conveyor belts, not systems, but the belts themselves and silicone rubber die stamp products and adhesive back materials for hard drives and so on to selling computer-based telecom equipment for a company called Rome out of Santa Clara, California. Rome was the first Silicon Valley. It wasn't Silicon Valley in those days. Rome was the one that started that. And it was ROLM was the name of the company.
Okay.
And so I went from rubber to phone equipment. I didn't know anything about that either, but I knew how to sell by then. And I was confident that I could learn this new technology and learn how to become successful in that. So I applied myself. I finished first in my class, a three-week class, training class you went through up in Santa Clara. I finished first in that. Got into the field and suffered mightily because they had put me into a new business development sales position, whereas I was expecting to be an account representative. So I would have clients. And you'll appreciate this because I know you've done plenty of cold calling in your career. I didn't like cold calling at all. And so I was put into a position where I felt like I was not in my element because I was knocking on doors, walking door to door, asking about your phone equipment, making cold calls, getting rejected, all the stuff that you go through when you're starting your broker career, but it was not my thing. And I really struggled with it. And I actually got to the point where I was ready to make a change in my career. And I went to my manager and I told her so, and she was not happy at all about it because I had finished first in my class and I was expected to be a success. And she said, well, what do you think I should do? I said, put me in the position that you hired me for, which was to call on the installed base, people who've already got our stuff. Let me sell add-ons. I'll have a reason for them to see me. And so finally she did. And from that moment, my career blossomed. I wound up in the next year, I wound up being the top salesperson of 30 in my office in the West San Fernando Valley. The next year after that, I was in the top 10 of the 30,000 salespeople on a national basis or global basis. And I never fell out of the top 10% from that point forward. And I think it was because I had a comfort in reaching out to people who I had a reason to talk to. I was there to bring them value. I was there to serve them. I wasn't there just to try to sell them something. And that was another lesson that I learned, that I'm much better at relational selling than I am just brute force, knocking on doors and trying to get my foot in the door. And that's kind of marked my whole career from there forward. I did the same thing when I got to Cushman and Wakefield and elsewhere. So that's kind of how my career at least got started.
That's awesome. Yeah, I don't think anyone likes to cold call, really.
It's brutal. Tough.
And I don't think, I mean, I guess certain companies, like larger companies like a CB or something, I think you can go in there and be able to do that as a broker where you're at least, I know a lot of people at the large broker shops, even Colliers and JLL and Cushman, where your business is other brokers within the organization and getting the inbound business.
Yeah.
And that's a lot more of a warmer way to do commercial real estate brokerage. But if you're going to be a broker who goes and finds their own deals, then I mean, the cold calling is basically forced upon you.
It seems.
If you're going to do that. So yeah, I had a very hard time figuring that out. And I won my first big account because it was a friend of mine worked for the company and his dad was the CFO. Okay. And that's how I won my first account. And before that, I mean, I was knocking on doors. I got hired by people, but nothing really significant until that point in time. And then I spent the next, I would say, 5 years, 6 years, just growing my business because they got bought by another company and then the CEO moved to another company and then this person moved there. So I knew the decision makers as they moved to other companies and I grew organically.
Okay.
And then in 2016, I hired Reagan Dixon.
Oh yeah.
Who you know.
Yeah.
As my business coach. And he goes, how many new appointments did you set this week, Ward? And I was like, none. So this is when it's 2016. So it's 10 years in the business.
Okay.
He goes, you need to go pick up the phone and set meetings with people. Like, dude, I do not like to do that. He's like, you have to do it if you want to hit these goals that we're talking about. So I actually Googled a YouTube video, how to make a cold call.
Really?
When I was 10 years into being a commercial real estate broker, because I'd really forgotten. And I didn't know how to sell doing the multi-market account stuff because I was trained to cold call on a sub-market basis. So I was like, I don't even know. No one has ever trained me how to go after multi-market accounts. So I watched this video and read a bunch of books and then I figured it out. But it's very intimidating.
It is. You've been through my pack mentality presentation. You know how I feel about these things.
We're going to talk about that for sure.
Okay.
Because I'm all about, I want people to learn things. And that is such a great example of what we're talking about, really.
Yeah.
But I will just add on, after I read all these books and did this and researched it, I put all this stuff to work and I wrote a blog called How to Make Cold Calling Not Suck.
Okay.
So I'll put a link to it on here. I need to do a podcast on it.
Yeah, I'd love to see that.
But I mean, this might be a good time to talk about the pack mentality in your presentation that you've shared with me.
Yeah, sure.
I had you give it to my whole team, actually.
We did. And it was great fun. It's the whole idea about, it's a rework of how we network. And what I did is I did a tremendous amount of studying, that, again, through COVID as well, about how we as a species operate. And there are several things about us humans that Marcus is different from a lot of other, obviously, other species. One is that we have a higher level of thinking, and most animals don't. But we also have this base level thinking. And that base level thinking is inside all of us all the time. We can't turn it off. It's always just kind of simmering there, and it will present itself when necessary. And one of the things that I learned about, for example, is that, you know, we humans don't like being surprised. And we also don't like the unknown. We fear the unknown, as a matter of fact. And we also fear strangers. And these are all kind of genetic things that have gone through our species for thousands of years that got our ancient ancestors through some pretty tough times. And so there are these characteristics that are common in all humans. And that goes globally. It doesn't matter your sex, race, creed, color, religion, any of those things are sitting well above the forces that are kind of constantly brewing inside each one of us. And what I've done is I did a study on how our natural instincts play into our willingness to network. And one of the key things that I discovered was that we humans like living in the familiar. We don't like new things because new things cause us to have to think. And one of the truths about us is our brain is only about 2% of our body mass, but it consumes up to 20% of our glucose. And so our brains our coding that runs us is written in such a way that our brains like to shut down. Kind of like modern cars where you pull up to a stop sign and the engine stops.
Yeah, yeah.
Our brains do the same thing. And so we naturally want to live in the familiar, is what I call it. So when networking, cold calling, in and of itself, you call somebody up, they don't know who you are, you've just interrupted them. We also don't like to be startled by loud sounds. Well, phones can often be loud, especially if you're in a quiet environment. All of a sudden, the phone rings and your heart leaps. And what your body is doing is it's reacting to that being startled. And as a result, it's very uncomfortable for us. So, and then if you do pick up the phone, now I'm talking to a stranger. If I don't know you, I'm talking to a stranger. And I've been told since I was a kid, beware of strangers. So now you're in my space, in my hand, and I don't know who you are, and it causes me to be very stressful. That's kind of a very natural reaction for our species. And so when I'm networking, I don't do cold calls hardly ever. I use LinkedIn instead. And the reason I use LinkedIn is because if someone has already signed up for LinkedIn, they're already part of the LinkedIn pack. And we humans are a pack animal. We like being around people that are like us. We like being around people who have common interests because they're familiar. Even if I don't know you, if we like the same things, well, there's a familiarity there because we're running in the same pack.
Yeah.
And so the idea behind it is I will do what I call appealing to the familiar. I'll do my studying when there's someone I want to meet. I'll go on CB's website and read up on somebody from CB, and then I'll go on JLL's, the same thing, and then I'll find them on LinkedIn. And if I find out they went to SMU, for example, in my first connection with someone, I'll say, hey, I took a night school class at SMU and my son played 4 years in the best dressed band in the line. And so what I'm saying is we may not know each other yet, but I'm not a stranger. We just haven't met. We run in this same circle. And then once that connection is made, I call it my pack mentality. We're then part of the same pack. And there are psychological and physiological dynamics that happen in packs. You can see it if you watch a wolf pack, for example, that changes when you become a pack member. And so it's a big part of what I use to network is keeping in mind what we are as a species and using that to my advantage when I'm trying to meet people I don't yet know.
And we've talked about it like you've used me as an example. We're in lots of packs.
Yes, we are.
And we worked together, we didn't work together. We were in the same office. We had met, I watched you give a presentation, but we never worked on a deal.
Yeah.
And then you found me in the LinkedIn pack, and then K-Rod from Cushman & Wakefield joined my team, and you're friends with K-Rod.
That's
and
correct.
So we're in the K-Rod pack.
We were pack mates. That's right.
And then we went to lunch, and then we found out that we're in the music pack.
Correct.
And then we're in the book writing pack.
That's right.
And the real estate pack.
That was the surprising one. Yeah, I actually had taken K-Rod to lunch, and she mentioned you were writing a book, and we hadn't talked about that. We knew what one another was musicians. So
we'd already been to one lunch, and we were in the music pack, but you didn't know I was in the book writing pack.
Yeah. So I never forget, I wrote you a quick little note and said, hey, K-Rod says you're a writer. I am too. We got to get together and talk about writing sometime. And so that's how that whole thing happened. And each time that happens, you get to know someone at another level, another layer that, again, we as a species really like. It's just one more way for our lives, our histories, and our interests to be linked together. And we like that stuff as a species. That makes us feel comfortable. And we like being comfortable.
Yeah, man. I love that. So take me through the rest of your career. Quickly, the highlights, and then we can talk about what you're doing now and then move on to the next part.
So after Boyd, I went to work for Rome. I was there for 13 years. That was an interesting time too. I don't know that I've ever shared this with you before, but I was in graduate school at USC in 1994. We were coming up on Martin Luther King's birthday, January 17th, 1994. And the Northridge earthquake hit, and we essentially lost our house in that. That's why I actually moved to Texas, was because our house was so badly damaged. We couldn't live in it for 9 months. We got a big loan through FEMA to get it rebuilt. A lot of my neighbors just said to the banks, take it back. We don't want it. It's not worth, fixing. I didn't want that on my credit history. And so I went ahead and took the loan out, got the house fixed, and then came to Texas. I was still with Rome at the time. I was here for just a couple of years. And then I decided to leave. It was time to make a change. And what happened was the guy who had been the sales instructor in Santa Clara when I first started with Rome, he was the class instructor, the main instructor. He'd moved to Houston, and he heard that I had moved to Dallas. So he called me up shortly after I got here and said, basically, I want to hire you. So from the good works, this is a career lesson, you know, never burn a bridge and always do your best because people won't forget. Well, this guy didn't forget. I came in knowing very little and I finished first in my class. I'm now here and he wanted to hire me. So he made me an offer that I couldn't refuse. It was a startup technology design consulting firm. That's where I started to work with brokers because in those days, this would have been the late 90s.
The telecom boom.
Telecom boom was going. And so you guys would often want to have a technical person go with you on a presentation and say, look, I'm going to do your real estate, but this guy is going to take care of all your technology and make sure that everything works. So that's what I did. I did that for 5 years. I got to know the Cushman and Wakefield people. And when they needed a business developer to help sell project management services, they tapped me. So I left the consulting firm, went to C&W where I was for the next 19 years, started in Dallas alone, got that platform set up and going. Then they moved me into a regional position where I was doing the same thing, essentially going with brokers on pitches and selling the project management services. And then I had from Chicago to Houston. And then after 3 or 4 years, they put me into a national role. And in my last 10 years, I was part of their national industrial leadership team, where, again, I was supporting Unilever and a couple of other of their big global corporate accounts from a project management perspective. So I did that for 10 years. And then long story short, after the DTZ merger with Cushman and Wakefield, the management whole team changed. And I realized my position was, I was not where I wanted to be any longer. And so I had been working with Ryan Companies for about 4 years on a large office build-to-suit project in Phoenix. And as my runway at C&W was coming to a close, I sat down with the leadership team at the Ryan office in Phoenix. And we'd become friends by then. We'd worked together roughly 5 years. And so we'd become good friends. And that's one of the things that I also prided myself in is if I'm going to work with you, I'm going to be your friend. You know, and so I would find these personal connections. And one of the things about being in a pack is that pack members will help other pack members. They'll willingly do it. In fact, it's kind of coded into our DNA that we want to do that. Because if a member of my pack wins, I win too, because we're in a pack together. So I went to the Ryan team and I told them what was happening. And they said, well, gosh, would you ever even consider coming to work with us? And I told them, yeah, I'd be happy to. Well, the next day, this was out in Phoenix. The next day was the C&W, was the 2019 C&W International Industrial Broker Conference. And I was attending. Ryan Companies was a sponsor of the event. And the last thing they did after this two-day event, the last thing they did was they handed out the big national awards. And the last award given was something called the Spirit of Oneness Award. It was awarded by Sean Mobley. It's an achievement award of sorts, but it's not a production achievement award. It's an award that's voted on by the industrial brokers, and it's given to the non-broker colleague they most like collaborating with. And when they announced the winner on the two big screens, there was my face, and I couldn't believe it. I was literally dumbfounded. But I got this really nice trophy and a nice pictures taken, and as soon as it happened, my phone started blowing up. Well, come to find out, Brian Jensen, who was running communications for Cushman and Wakefield at that time, was there and he knew I was going to win. So as soon as it was announced, he put it out on all the C&W social media sites. And I was getting notes from friends in France and Germany and down in Brazil and the UK, all over the place. And so my phone is just buzzing in my pocket as I'm standing there holding this trophy, getting my picture taken. I go back to my seat and I take out my phone and I start looking at my texts. And the very first text I got was from my contact at Ryan Companies. And her comment said, I think your price just went up. So yeah, that's how I started my career at Ryan, and it's been great. I'm part of the national build-to-suit team, so I live in Dallas, but I have responsibility for right now. When I started, I had responsibility for the whole country. What I was doing was going well enough that we've now hired somebody in Atlanta and somebody in Phoenix, so the country's not divided into three because we're all part of one team. We help each other. We're pack mates, so we're constantly helping one another find brokers and look for leads and things like that. But my geographic focus now is on the central U.S.
Yeah, that's great.
And the offices that we have in the central U.S.
So cool. What's your superpower, do you think?
It's funny, Ward. I've thought about that because I heard you ask that same question of others. I think mine is that I know what I do well, and I work hard to stay in that lane. I'm a people person. I can concentrate and I do when necessary, but my real strength is I think connecting with people very quickly and appealing to the familiar, finding things that we can bond over and then growing relationships. And I'm a big, big believer in, you got to make it personal. If it stays the generic kind of, you know, nice to see you at the cocktail reception basis, and you don't go any further than that, you're missing out on some of the most powerful relationships that you'll ever have. And I had an opportunity, as a matter of fact, recently, when I was at the memorial service for Mike Wyatt, Piper, Mike's wife, knew that I wrote, and Mike's read a couple of the things that I'd written, and she knew that. What she didn't know was that my ninth story was one that Mike actually inspired when he handed me a newspaper clipping. And in this newspaper clipping, it talked about how the Russians had just decided that their geographic territory, their country limits, went all the way to the North Pole. So the slice that went up from Russia all the way up to the North Pole, which was international waters, now it belonged to Russia. And he thought, Randy, there's a story there. And so I looked it over and I thought, no, there's not really, I'm not getting a story out of this. But it did inspire a short story. So I wrote this, it was about a 12-page short story. And I wrote that, and I went into Mike's office one day and I said, I want to read something to you. And he goes, okay, go ahead. And so I read him this short story. It was sort of inspired by this newspaper article that he'd clipped and left on my desk. And he loved it. And he said, Randy, not only is this good enough to get you published, but what I really want you to do is there's 12 pages here. What I want you to do is I want you to write what happened before those 12 pages started. And then after you finish those 12 pages, what happened on both ends of that event? And that inspired my ninth book. And I told Piper that story, and she did not know that. And she has since said she'd like to read it. So I'm looking forward to having her book report when she's had a chance to finally read that story.
Rest in peace, Mike Wyatt.
Amen, brother.
What a great guy.
Yep.
That's when I met you. I was working for Mike.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. I talk about him on like every podcast lately. I was talking about him before he passed away and wanting him on here, but I never picked up the phone and asked him. And he was on my list. And
larger than life. He had quite a life.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. So what advice would you give to your younger self?
I heard you ask this one, too. I'm gonna literally throw you a curveball on this one. My advice to my younger self was learn to hit a goddamn curveball. When I was a junior in high school, baseball was my sport.
Okay.
I love playing football, but I really like baseball. I grew up a Dodger fan. My grandfather had season tickets to the Dodgers. I spent a lot of time in Dodger Stadium, and I really loved the mental aspect of baseball, which really is a very mental game.
Oh yeah.
And so,
I never was good at baseball. I have horrible vision.
Oh, do you really?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, so, then, yeah, that'd be tough if you're trying to hit a round ball with a round bat squarely. That's not an easy thing to do. So in my junior year in high school, I led the team in home runs. Between my junior year and my senior year, somehow it seemed all of the pitchers learned how to throw a curveball. And so my senior year, I led our team in strikeouts. And years later, you've seen the movie Major League with Charlie Sheen?
Yeah.
Okay.
Oh, yeah.
Serrano, Pedro Serrano, the guy with the little voodoo character. He could hit fastballs all day long. But whenever they start throwing curves, he'd be whiffing. And everybody thought that was so funny. I didn't think that was funny at all, Ward, because I could exactly relate where he was coming from. And it was like, oh my gosh. So if I'd have just learned to hit a curveball, I probably would have tried to play baseball in college. But that, alas, that didn't happen. But I did have a really strong throwing arm, which is why they had me in right field. One of the things that most don't realize is that the longest throws come from right field, because third base is far away and home plate is far away. Second is close, but for left fielders, second base and third base are equidistant. So I had a really strong throwing arm, and I had a couple of friends who were on the track team, and they said, you got to come out and learn how to throw the javelin. So I did, and I wound up doing pretty well. I wasn't an Olympic-caliber javelin thrower, but I was good enough to get a partial scholarship to Cal State Long Beach when I was done at Pierce College. I wound up hurting my elbow to the point where I knew I wasn't going to go any further with it, and I thought, I'm just hurting myself. Let's not bother. So I was only there for one semester, a fall season, and then came back and finished at Cal State Northridge. So yeah, my advice to myself would have been, go find a batting coach and learn how to hit a curveball, because who knows what my trajectory of my life might have been had I done that. But
true.
Water under the bridge, can't do anything about it now.
No doubt about it. What's the greatest obstacle that you've ever come?
The greatest obstacle I think I've ever overcome was the Northridge earthquake. We mentioned it a little bit earlier.
Oh, yeah.
You know, I was
losing your house. I can't even imagine.
It was just the trauma of it. It was 1994. I was doing great. I'd already had my first son was born. My second son was due in a week or two, and you know, the house was fixed up. I was at the Maslow's hierarchy of needs. I was sitting at the very top of that. And in 20 minutes time, 4:31 in the morning, when that earthquake hit, all of that stuff that I had put in place, all of my planning, all of my expectations about what life was going to be like over the next 4 or 5 years, it was all completely shattered. And I mean literally shattered, to the point where when I got out of bed, I was there by myself. It was 4:31 in the morning. The house felt like I was inside a snow globe, and some little two-year-old was just, you know, doing this with the snow globe that was my house. The fireplace was breaking in half. All the glass that we had in the house had crashed and broken and all that. And we talked about the pack mentality earlier and kind of some of the stuff that's in us that aren't in our genetic coding. One of the most base instincts we have is fight or flight. And so when pressed into a really seriously stressful environment, we will default to either running or fighting. If we can't run, we'll fight. And so as I was thrown out of bed at 4:31 in the morning, it was pitch black. The siren is going off, the burglar alarm, because the power has been cut. And the whole house was just shaking like a frightened dog that was about to get beaten. I ran because I knew I wasn't going to be able to beat an earthquake. I had that much sense, but I was barefooted and couldn't see a thing. We had flashlights throughout the house, but the furniture wasn't where it was before the earthquake hit. So I didn't know where anything was. So I ran. And I ran down the wooden stairs, and we had family pictures behind glass frames up on that wall. They had all come off the wall and shattered. So I was literally running across broken glass, trying to get to the door to get outside. And about the time I got downstairs, that first quake stopped. And I stood there at the front door, which we had keyed with the lock, because there was a window right next to the door. And if you had a lock with a twist, you could just break that window, reach in and unlock the thing. So recently we'd put a key. Well, that was fine until the key that would open that front door was in a pile of rubble behind me. And I had no idea how to get out. So about that time too, I could feel my feet were bleeding and they were bleeding pretty badly. So I hurried back upstairs across the glass again. I found a flip-flop and a tennis shoe, and I put those on, and that's how I got out of the house. But even still, it took me about 30 minutes to figure out how to get out of the house, knowing that the front door wasn't an option. I tried going through the living room, but even in a room like yours, if you can imagine, it's pitch black, and all of your furniture has been moved around. I kept bumping into things. There was no light at all. I couldn't figure out a way to get out. It took me about 30 minutes to finally find a way to get out of the house. That has stayed with me ever since. And so, you know, when I'm on a jet airplane, people ask, what's a earthquake like? If you go through a really rough patch of turbulence in a jet airplane, that's what it feels like. It feels like that. That's that same sensation. Very, very similar. So, if you want to know what being in a big earthquake is like, go for a bumpy ride in an airplane. And because again, for the most part, you don't know when turbulence is going to start and you don't know when it's going to stop. Earthquakes are very much the same way.
No, thank you.
Yeah, no, it's something to be avoided if possible. I would have loved to have avoided it if possible, but I will tell you this, Ward, it cost me the house and a whole lot of money, but if that's what it took to get me to move to Texas, I'm happy to have done so.
I love it here. It's great. I do love Southern California too, though.
It's got its pluses.
I'm going there next week.
Okay.
Looking forward to it. I got an Airbnb in Malibu.
Okay. Well, that's hard to beat. Yeah.
Just for a night, but just like, even I'm still, gonna do it. Just go be on the beach.
There's still a lot of great stuff out there. I mean, I got no hard feelings. I grew up in Los Angeles in the 80s. You know what a dink is?
No.
Okay, so I wasn't sure if that term would translate to your generation. A dink was dual income, no kids. So I was a dink and we were doing really well. And in those days in the 80s, the Dodgers won the World Series. You know, the Lakers had Kareem and the Magic Show and all of that. Great concerts coming to town, the Fabulous Forum, you know, but they didn't have a professional football team in those days, which is one of the reasons why I chose to go to USC for graduate school, because they kind of became the de facto professional team in those days, the Matt Leinart days and the Reggie Bush days. I didn't partake in any of it. There was cocaine everywhere. People were happy. There was a lot of money. I ran into celebrities from time to time. I had lunch at a place called Hampton's. in Studio City where Bo and John Derek were sitting at the table next to us, which was kind of fun to bump into them. And so you'd see celebrities now and again. Cyndi Lauper, would see her from time to time. And those were pretty heady days.
That's
and,
so cool.
Yeah, it was a lot of fun to be an Angelino, a native Angelino in the 80s in Los Angeles.
No doubt. So have you ever had a mystical experience?
I don't think so. I've had some experiences that I would leave it up to others to decide, but I don't think so. One, I will share an example of one, and I'll put it to you whether or not you think there's any sort of otherworldly. Although I write about it in many of my books, I write about the subject a lot, but personally I haven't. Now, I will tell you on my 13th book, which is called The 13th, and the number 13 is an unlucky number typically. And I was getting ready to change jobs. I was coming up on Friday, September 13th of 2019. I was starting at Ryan Companies on Monday the 15th. So I was looking at my calendar and I knew I'd started playing with some ideas for my 13th book. And I decided, all right, since 13th, this is the book that I'm going to be writing. I'm going to start writing on a Friday the 13th, which is supposed to be a bad luck day. And then I decided that I would fill the book with references and other things that deal with the number 13 to try to make 13 a lucky number for me instead of an unlucky number.
Yeah.
And this book is episodic in that there are events that take place in U.S. history following World War I. And then in the next chapter, you're in kind of a mystical land where my protagonist's character, his name is Griffin, where Griffin wakes up. The first time he's there, he wakes up. He doesn't really know where he is. But it's this kind of mystical land, and there's a horse outside. He knows the horse's name is Restless, but he doesn't know why he knows the horse's name is Restless. He just knows. And so he gets on this horse, and the horse takes him across this pristine pasture. In the distance, he sees three flags waving. There's a white flag, a black flag, and in the middle, there's a big red flag. The tallest of the three is this red flag, and it's got a griffin on it, the lion with wings. And so he figures, okay, well, my name's Griffin. I must be in the right place at least. He winds up at this tent where inside he finds Princess Hope and Hope's high counselor and then Hope's nine judges. The high counselor is dressed all in white for the white flag, and the judges are dressed head to toe in black. Their faces are covered. You don't see anything but their eyes. And so they're the black flag. And so I had written Griffin in this mystical land about six chapters worth. So six times I had visited this location with Griffin. It was only on the seventh that I stop and count the number of inhabitants in this mystical land. And it was Griffin, his horse Restless, Princess Hope, the High Counselor, and the nine judges. You add that up, that adds up to 13. And I didn't know what had happened. It was not planned. It just happened. So mystical? I don't know. I think our brains are remarkable devices that figure stuff out. And I think subconsciously, knowing that this was my 13th book, and I wanted to take advantage of that number to try to turn it into something good for me. It just happened. But it was weird when I would realize it. I got goosebumps when it happened.
I would call that a mystical experience. I actually, I'll quote Willie Nelson on this.
Okay.
I just finished watching his Netflix docuseries okay. on him, which is fantastic, by the way. And they were asking him, like, what, you know, like, how do you write a good song? Because he has so many hit songs.
Oh,
but
yeah.
Of course, he had so many non-hit songs also. So yeah. When he gets the hit, he was talking about it. And he just said, the first thing I do is I give gratitude to God because God writes the songs. I'm just the vessel.
Oh, wow.
And I feel that way when I write songs and when I'm in my book writing. Now, not every song, right? But the good ones, and especially the ones that write themselves very quickly. So yeah. I would assume that when you're writing in general, that at times you'll get into a flow state and you're like, wow.
Turn left on Killarney Drive.
Oh, gosh. Hey, it's like Siri is joining us for the podcast.
And bug out.
Yeah. But, man, I think, do you feel that when you're writing sometimes where
yes.
you're not, your mind's, it could be your mind, but it's also like you're almost channeling just like thoughts and all of a sudden an hour or two has gone by and it feels like 5 minutes. I think that is a mystical experience for me.
Okay. I do exactly the same thing, Ward. When I get on airplanes, I often ride on airplanes because I can't be unproductive. So I'll bring out my laptop and I'll start writing. And a flight that lasts 3.5 hours, I completely lose track of time. And it is, I'll just share something else with you. When I first started learning to write, I took a class at SMU, night school class at SMU. The instructor was an author, published author, a brilliant woman named Patricia Anthony. She's since passed away, but she really liked my style, liked my voice, and really mentored me over the next 10 years after the class was over. And one of the things that she said was, in fact, when she started the class, she got up, introduced herself, told us about the books that she'd written and the genre that she wrote. And she said, now I'm here to tell you there are three types of writers, but only one type ever gets published. The first is the creative. And the creative is the person who sits down at the laptop or the computer and just starts going. And they're so creative. They write in what she called purple prose. And they're very undisciplined. And they never get published because their writing is just so flowery and colorful and that they're not taken seriously. So that's the first one, the creative. The second one is the editor. And the editor is the person who sits down and says, it was a dark and stormy night. Oh, that's crap. Back. Mm-hmm. You know, and so they never get published either because they never finish. And then the third is the only type that ever gets published. And these are 1 in 10,000. And she said, and that's the extremely colorful, creative writer who is a brutal self-editor. I leaned more on the creative side. I had to learn to be a brutal self-editor. Mm-hmm. I also learned that I couldn't do them at the same time. I had to do them separated. So when I'm writing creatively, and I think this goes to perhaps the kind of the mystical experience that you're suggesting this is, when I'm writing creatively, I write with my eyes closed. I don't watch the words going onto the screen. I'm watching the scene in my head. I'm trying to feel what my characters are feeling, because I write in what's called third person intimate point of view, which means I put you into the brain, into the mind of the character that's going to carry that given scene. And so I'm trying to feel what they're feeling, whether I'm one of my favorite characters was a little boy named Justin. He was a 5-year-old little boy with albinism. And I tried to, what would it feel like to be a 5-year-old with albinism? How would he see the world? How would he describe it? How would he experiencing it? And so I put the reader into the head of that kid. And then in the next chapter, I might be in the head of an 80-year-old, janitor at a middle school somewhere. And I put you in that head. And so these characters carry the story forward and allow me to experience, as the author, allow me to experience all these different feelings based upon a given character's age, their sex, their background, their interests. For example, the piece that's behind you on the wall, I don't have any idea what you would call that thing. To me, it's a sort of a rectangular box with some wood cutouts and some strings across and some tuning pins up at the top. And you'd probably, now if I was in my point of view, that's how Randy would describe it. But Ward would look over his shoulder and he'd go, oh, there's my whatever you call that thing.
I call it a Lobro.
There you go.
Because my buddy named Lo made it. And it's kind of like a Dobro, but it's a Lobro.
Okay. So that's exactly the sort of thing. And I love things like that because as the author, I would then have Ward, who knows what it is, call it a Lobro. And so that's why I have to carefully pick the character that's going to experience a given scene because they're going to carry the story forward. And I'll share one more thing with you about the kind of experience that you just suggested earlier. My eighth book took me almost 2 years to finish. It was a struggle. It did not feel mystical at all. It was brute force to get through that thing. I started with a set of characters and they changed sex, they changed age, they changed background. And every time that happened, I had to go back and rewrite all this. It was brute force. And I wrote to my agent. I said, okay, here it is. I almost flung it at her. Here it is. This is book 8. Go sell this thing, because if you don't, I'm not going to write anything more. I'm done. I'm burned out. And so she said, just be patient, give yourself time. And after I heard that, that's when Mike dropped this article on my desk. And 3 months later, book 9 was completely finished, start to finish, the whole thing. And it literally felt like it was writing itself. I wake up in the morning anxious to get to my computer because I knew exactly what was going to happen. I just let it go. And again, I was writing with my eyes closed. And that wound up being one of my very favorite stories of all time. And it's one that my agent says is going to be made into a movie one of these days. So we'll see. But it's a great story. It's a fun one.
I'm rooting for you.
Yeah, thanks.
And you have a pen name that you write under.
I do. Yeah, I wanted to keep, I thought about this a lot. I wanted to keep my fiction writing world separate from my career world. And so I write under Randall D. St. Clair. My brother, as a matter of fact, is Stephen St. Clair. My family name is Thompson. So was my brother's, but he discovered it through a genealogical search in his college years that we had a family member who, through a very bad relationship, wound up changing her last name from St. Clair to Thompson in order to get away from an abusive husband. And so my brother found out about that, and he thought, I like the St. Clair name better, and that gives us our historical ties back to Scotland, which is what we've got, deep roots in Scotland. And so he changed his name to St. Clair. Well, I've stayed Thompson. And when I thought about, you know, writing under a pen name and putting out my social media platforms and all of that stuff, I decided I would use my first name, which is Randall. My middle name is David, so Randall D. And then I took the St. Clair name that my brother has. So that's what I write under when I'm writing creatively. I still have lots of stuff published in the nonfiction world and magazines. And I was just asked by Christine Perez to write 4 articles for them for D Magazine this year.
Oh, cool.
I've got my first one. It's drafted. I just need to finalize the word count with Christine, and then that will be out. So I do have those things published, but none of my fiction work has been published yet. But this, damn it, Ward, this is the year. It's going to happen this year. I finished my 14th book, and my agent is working through it right now. She plans on sending it out in probably the end of this month. It'll be going out to the publishers, and hopefully we'll have a chance to actually know what it feels like to be a published author.
I learned so much from what you just said. I'm still working on my book, which has been going on for 4 years. Yeah. I started right in the middle of COVID, but it doesn't, I mean, I haven't been working on it nonstop for 4 years. I've taken long breaks, and actually the story is still continuing. Mm. So and that might be a problem with writing a memoir.
That's exactly right. I was going to say, it's like, well, I get to make stuff up. You're doing stuff.
I never satisfied.
Real. Yeah, no kidding.
I had a good ending, and then it's like, oh shit, but what happened in the next 3 years? I'm going to have to talk about this.
There can always be a sequel.
There can be a sequel. Series. Yeah, there can be. And so that might be it, but I love the process. But actually I found myself right now going back and editing this, you know, latest add on to the book, but I still need to do some more of the free flow writing. And then I should just go back and edit this whole last half, last third really. So that's, I've loved the experience of writing. One cool thing about doing a memoir, I have one main character, me.
Right.
However, there's really like 13 main characters because of the different times of my life, the different ways that I've been. Mm-hmm. And writing it was like time travel and having to go,
interesting.
Put, if you imagine writing about yourself as a child or in high school or in college or when you're playing in a band and I was out of control at times during my life and then like a big time athlete and doing these different things, and it takes you back there where it's this very emotional where you, and I'm sure I would imagine you get this way writing about fictional characters too, is you've got to go put yourself in your head and you kind of got to take on some of that energy.
Yeah.
Like if you're writing about a bad person or a good person, like you probably walk away from that session like, God, let me go jump in a hot shower after writing.
It can be exhausting. I had a scene toward the end of a book, I think it was my third novel, where my protagonist was raised in foster care. His parents were killed in a car crash when he was young. And so he was raised in foster care, and he was mad at them. And essentially they, because of their car crash, as a 6-year-old, his thinking was, you've ruined my life. What, you know?
Yeah.
And he's carried that up to this point. Well, now he's engaged. He's getting ready to get married. And the day before he goes to get married, he decides it's time for closure with my parents. And he goes to the cemetery where he knows his parents are buried, but he hasn't been there since he was 6. And he's now, I think close to 30, if I recall correctly in that story. And he's engaged, and he gets to the cemetery, and he doesn't know where his parents are because the trees that were small in those days had grown. And so the things that he had seen, he remembered as a little kid, they didn't look the same. And it was an unsettling feeling for him. And so I'm writing this, and again, I've got my eyes closed. This was actually still back in California when I'd first started writing. And so I'm pounding away. And in this scene, he wanders around and finally he finds where his parents' gravestones are. And he starts talking to them and telling them about, you know, what his life has been like and how he's, you know, he wasn't proud at first. He got himself in a lot of trouble. He did wind up pulling himself up. And they would be, he said to them, I think you'd be proud of me. And when he did that, he started to cry. So I'm sitting there with my eyes closed, feeling this inside of this, and I'm riding away and I'm weeping, weeping. And that's how tightly, when I'm writing in that third person intimate point of view, that's how tightly I want to have that skin on, so that I'm feeling things that my characters are feeling in the way that they're feeling them, so like I can describe it in a way that is meaningful. So yeah. That's to your point. Yes, I do very that. Much do that.
Wow. Thanks for sharing.
Yeah.
What's your morning ritual?
I've heard you ask this too. And I know the high achievers that are part of your part of your podcast tend to be people who are up at 4:30 in the morning and they get their day started.
Everybody says that, but I feel like more people say that than actually do that.
Truth of the matter is I usually am up by 4:30. I go into the bathroom, I pee, and then I go back to bed. So that's my morning ritual. True story. I'm going to be 65 in July. It happens, you know, with age.
How do you look so good for 65?
Oh God, I don't know. I really don't know. I try to take care of myself.
Do you work out?
I do almost every day.
When?
Usually late afternoons. I have a LA Fitness up near where I live now, and I go swim.
That's a great thing to do.
It's good for my joints, good for my heart. It's easy on the body, so I swim a lot.
What's your diet like? Do you eat out a lot?
I do, right? But I'm very careful. I usually, when I'm out, because I entertain a lot when I'm taking brokers, and when I travel, it gets especially hard because, you know, restaurants tend to have large portions. So I tend to order off of the appetizer menu. I'll usually order a salad and just a small appetizer of some sort. And that's typically what I'll go by.
Have you ever had issues keeping alcohol in check when you take people out to fancy dinners and throw parties all the time?
I have not. I'm a very ardent, firm believer that I don't drink and drive. And I if I am entertaining someone in a bar, I will have a glass of wine, and that's going to last me the evening until I get back home again. Because unless I'm staying somewhere, I may have a second glass if I'm staying at a hotel or a conference, and I know you just got to wander to my room. But no, I don't want to let inebriation get in the way of good judgment and good sense, especially in a business environment where, you know, if you're not careful, something could go terribly wrong, terribly fast. And I don't ever want to put myself in a position where that might happen.
Yeah. I had it in my head that everybody got drunk at real estate conferences because that's what I used to do. And I would hang out with a group of people and we all did that. So I assumed everybody did that.
Yeah.
And then when I quit drinking, I started going and realizing that actually there's a higher percentage of people who don't do that. And it was amazing to me. And yet you're definitely one person. I've never seen you intoxicated before in my life.
You never will.
But I've seen you out at, you know, we go to bars and dinners to hang out most of the time because of the nature of our job.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Don't get me wrong. I like a good glass of wine. My favorite drink is a old fashioned. I love a good old fashioned.
Yeah.
But I'll have one.
Yeah.
And
that's how it's done.
Yeah.
That's the way to do it. Well, and then
if I got a friend who has had too much, I'm sober. I can make sure they get to their room or get home, you know?
Yeah.
I'd rather be that guy.
And no judgment, by the way, to any of our listeners out there who like to get shit-faced real estate.
Not at all.
I'm more power to you. Let's see. What's your favorite vacation destination?
There are two, actually three. In the list, domestically here in the U.S., I love Utah. And the reason I love Utah is because I'm an outdoors kind of guy.
Yeah.
When my kids were growing up, we rode off-road motorcycles and we rode all over Colorado and Utah. The difference between the two is Colorado is high mountain riding. And when you're in a carbureted motorcycle, the bikes won't start when you get up above 10,000 feet. You got to be very careful. In Utah, there's similar landscape, but it's more a lot lower levels. There's some mountains in Utah as well, but most of the, I shouldn't say most, I don't even know the percentage of a lot of the trails in and around Utah, Moab in particular, and Richfield and a number of other places. They're not at sea level, obviously, but they're not, you know, 10, 12, 14,000 feet up. Like you find an engineer pass in Colorado, you know, they're 4,000 or 5,000 feet. And so, I love off-roading and motorcycles. I just bought my new Jeep Gladiator, which I've already taken out to Bridgeport, the four-wheel park out there. Had a great time. I'm learning how to drive an off-road four-wheel drive vehicle. I'll be, you know, tooting around in Colorado and Utah on summer vacations going forward. So that's my favorite destination in the U.S.
Have you ever been to Tropic Utah?
Oh, yes. Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah. One of my friends, a steel guitar player in Nashville, he just moved his family out there.
To Tropic.
Yeah.
Small town.
He opened a country and Western supper club, and they have shows like seven nights a week during the summer there. So if you're ever out there during the summer, you got to go check it out.
I will go check it out. So yeah, I've been through Tropic, and there's a lot of great places to ride and explore in and around Utah. And then internationally, I love Venice and I love London. I would go back to both of those in a heartbeat. Now, there's a lot of other places I haven't been yet that are on my list, but I'll get to them.
Yeah. Yeah, you will. Amazing. What's your favorite restaurant?
In Dallas, a little restaurant called Mercat Bistro. And I'm probably not pronouncing that right, but who knew France was so close? I love that place. The people there are great. The food is great. It's a menu unlike anything else that you have in Dallas. So
is that in Preston Center?
It's right in what are the buildings with all the samurai soldiers in them? Right near your office downtown.
Oh, Harwood. Yeah. You're exactly right.
Yeah,
love I've that been place. There before actually. It's been a long time.
My it's mom small and intimate. Restaurant. It's a great, you know, great place for business. Especially for guys that are officing in uptown, it can be walked. It's easily walked to. So yeah, that's my favorite place here in Dallas. And I'm a little bit of a foodie. I mean, I like going all over and trying lots of different things. But when I'm in uptown, that's typically where I'll go.
Yeah, cool. What's a book worth talking about today?
There are two that come to mind. In fact, I was talking with my team earlier today about this particular book. It's called The Future is Faster Than You Think. This is a business book. This is not for entertaining.
That's fine.
Although there are some entertaining things about it. If you think in terms of this book is a, it's written by Peter Diamandis and one other guy, I don't remember his name, but I've actually seen Peter speak. He's a futurist, but he's a brilliant man. He's got multiple doctorate degrees. And essentially what this book talks about is over the last 10 years, there's been a tremendous amount of development and advancements in things like 3D printing and in AI and in chemical engineering and biological engineering and medical devices. And they were kind of siloed, these vertical tiers as development was happening in each one of those spaces. But what his book talks about is how now those verticals are intertwining. And so you're having the ability to, for example, if I needed to have a kidney replaced, as a matter of fact, I had kidney cancer a few years ago. That was another one we can talk about if you want.
Oh, my gosh.
But yeah, that was a real shock.
I don't think I knew that.
Oh, yeah. That was quite a shock. And maybe I'll share that after I'm done with this thought. But if I had to have it replaced, they can now take my genetic coding out of my blood. They can create a biological compound that my body will not reject, and they can 3D print an operating kidney.
Oh my gosh.
And that's what's coming. In fact, in the speaking, I think it was NAOP up in Chicago where Peter spoke, he said it is very real likelihood that anyone 30 and under at some point in their life will have to make a decision as to how long they want to live because they're figuring out ways to turn on the cells that turn off that cause aging. They're learning how to turn them back on again. So if you're under 30, and you can get this process started. He said it's absolutely conceivable that humans could be living 200-400 years. You literally have to make a decision as to how long you want to live. And you will stop the aging process. So if you start this, say, at 40, you'll be 40 for 400 years, conceivably. I can't imagine that. But if you read The Future is Faster Than You Think, you'll see how he lays out the case that's where things are heading. And combine that with AI and some of the other stuff that's around the corner. Very interesting times indeed. So for business, The Future is Faster Than You Think. I can't recommend that highly enough. For pleasure, I would strongly recommend a book called Flanders, which is written by the woman that mentored me and who I learned from at SMU. Her name is Patricia Anthony. And Flanders I've read it at least six times. And it is a story about a 19-year-old Texan named Travis Lee Stanhope, who comes from a very abusive family situation. He hates his father. He has a younger brother named Bobby. And Travis Lee enlists in the British infantry as World War I is breaking out, and he's a sharpshooter. He grew up in West Texas plucking squirrels with his .22, and so he gets to the British ranks, and they try him out, and he's a marksman. They make him into a sniper, essentially. And the whole book are letters and postcards written by Travis Lee. So here's a 50-year-old Texan woman raised here who's now writing as a 19-year-old Texan in the British infantry over in Flanders, France. And the entire story is written in letters and postcards. They all start, "Dear Bobby, this is where we are today. This is what happened." It starts in letter format. And the longer of them, some of them are very short postcards. "Dear Bobby, on the move. I'll write you tomorrow." And then the next letter starts. Or some of them start with, "This is one I'll hand deliver because I don't want to send it in the mail." And it's a series of letters that start out in like a typical letter format. But then she almost imperceptibly moves out of that format into dialogue format, where there's quotes and descriptions and attributions for people who are talking. And then, so this whole next chapter might be 6 or 8 pages where it reads like a novel. And then as that story ebbs, she brings you back out of that again. So it's Travis Lee's voice again, saying goodbye to his brother. I mean, it's just brilliantly done. I'd never seen anything like that before. And her descriptions, she can be one of the most crass people I've ever read, but she's describing the horror of trench warfare through the eyes of a 19-year-old Texan who all the Brits make fun of because he's not a Brit, he's a Texan. And it's a brilliant, brilliant story. So for fun, I strongly recommend a book called Flanders.
Sounds so cool.
Yeah, it is really neat.
What about a song?
Okay, so my song that I'll share with you and your audience is by my favorite band, a band called Dream Theater. Have you ever heard of Dream Theater?
I feel like I have.
I
couldn't name a song.
I don't think they've ever had a song on the radio. They're a progressive rock band let me put it to you this way. If Wolfgang Amadeus Mozart and Rush were to have a love child, that's what Dream Theater is. So the song that I was going to mention to your audience was a song called Streams of Consciousness. It's an instrumental. It's about 11 minutes long, which is typical for Dream Theater. That's one of the reasons they don't have any material on the radio. They don't write short stuff. Their longest song is a song called Octavarian. It's 24 minutes long.
Yeah.
And it's in three pieces, three suites, if you will. But they're extraordinarily gifted musicians. The drummer, they've actually had two. Their founding drummer is a guy named Mike Portnoy, who I became a good drummer, a serviceable drummer for pop and jazz. But I wasn't a natural. I had to work hard at it. And then there's a guy like Mike Portnoy, who I'm sure he has worked really, really hard at it too. But when you watch him, the first time I heard Dream Theater song, you know what multi-tracking is, right? In the recording studio?
Yeah.
Okay. So the first time I heard a Dream Theater song, when I'm listening to music, I listen to the drums. That's what I see in my mind. I can hear all the other stuff, but I'm really hearing the drums. And I was listening to Portnoy play this song, and I thought, okay, these are clearly, it's multi-tracked. He's done this in 2 or 3 sessions, and then they've mashed them all together. No, I saw him play it live. He plays it just like that live. I couldn't believe what I was seeing. Just the speed and the double bass and just the precision through what they play is extraordinary complex time signatures.
Yeah.
You just have to hear it to understand it. But Stream of Consciousness, again, is one that it leans heavily into what I would call a classical rock.
Yeah.
It's just amazing.
Very cool. What about a quote?
Quote is 100% of the good things that you do that no one knows about never happened.
100% of the good things that you do
that no one knows about never happened. My message to that is, as a business person, we need to humbly find ways for those who are in a position to be able to have a positive outcome on our career. We have to make sure they know what we're doing. Because if they don't know what we're doing, in their minds, it never happened. So that's my message. And I share that with my sons and with the young people in the commercial real estate space that I mentor. That's one thing that they've got to be sure to do. The people who are in a position to influence your career have to know what you're doing, especially the good things.
Yeah, so true. In my book, I actually came up with this like 5-step process that I realized I use to accomplish everything of significance in my life.
Okay.
And I'll give you 2 of the steps. One is to create value.
Right.
And then the next step is to tell people who will benefit from the value you create about the value you create.
Oh, there you go.
You know what I mean?
Parallel to what I was just saying.
100%.
And I have 4. You said you have 5. I have 4 that I keep in mind every day. This is what I do every single day.
Yeah.
I stay curious. I stay humble. I make friends, and I solve problems.
Yeah.
Those are the four keys to my life that have really guided my career. I just keep those four things in mind constantly. And as long as I'm doing one of those four, good things will happen, even when your house gets knocked down by an earthquake.
So here's my five. One, have a clear intention. Two, seek expert advice. Three, create something of value. Four, tell people that will benefit from that value about the value you create. Number five, repeat steps 2, 3, and 4, but never change to step 1.
Oh, wow. That's awesome. I like that. Sense? Yes, it does. I like that.
If you want to do something, like the first step for me is go find someone else who's done something or at least something similar and go ask them how they did it.
Yeah.
And that saves you so much time.
It does. And you know, you brought back a memory of actually, it was at a Collier's conference. Were you there when Sebastian Terry spoke? The 100 things I'm going to do before I die guy.
Yeah.
One of the things that he said was, and I don't know if you'll remember this or not, were you in that session?
Cause I was.
When Q&A time came, I raised my hand because when I found out one of the 100 things he wanted to do was get a book published, and he had a checkbox next to that one. So I wound up talking to Seb, and one of the things that he said, I think very much in parallel to what you just said, was that you'll recall halfway through the session, he said, I want you to turn to the person next to you and say out loud, what is it you want what you want done? What is it? And he said, by saying that out loud, you're 50% more likely to achieve that end. And now if you say that out loud to someone in a position who can help you achieve that end, you're 94% more likely to achieve that end. And so that's why when I asked my question, I said, look, you've already done it. I want to make sure that I'm 94% more likely to make it happen rather than 50% more likely.
That's right.
And so he and I have spoken since, and he was actually instrumental in getting me in touch with a couple of people who wound up convincing me that it was time to create a website for my fiction writing side of my life, as well as my social media account. So that's what I did. And that was largely because Seb said, this is how you're going to achieve your end. And I want that to happen.
That's amazing. Let's see. What about a charity or cause that you donate your money to or time to or passionate about?
There are a couple. When first married, we didn't have a lot of money, but we felt like we needed to find something that we could support. So we wound up adopting some World Vision children, not physically adopting, but supporting them. And I've done that ever since. Right now I've got a 3-year-old named Genesis down in Peru that I'm supporting. I also support the National Kidney Foundation. I mentioned to you that I was diagnosed with renal cell carcinoma in 2015. Renal cell carcinoma, for those who don't know anything about it, when my doctor told me the news, he pulled out his iPad and put in, you know, renal cell carcinoma, blah, 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 and search. And up to the first headline, I'm sitting next to him in his office. The first headline I read was that 94% of people diagnosed with renal cell carcinoma live 6 months or less. And my doctor was still talking, but I was in like Charlie Brown's classroom with the teachers. Wah, 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 wah. You know, I'm looking at this headline and I'm thinking, I got less than 6 months to live. Are you kidding me? Well, come to find out that renal cell, the reason for that is the case. Renal cell typically doesn't present itself until it's metastasized, until it's in level 4. And by then it's gone to other organs.
Yeah.
And renal cell is a form of cancer that can't be treated. It doesn't take to radiation or chemo. So you have to take it out. And if those cells have gotten into another organ that you don't have two of, you're toast. Well, mine was a stage 1. It was only 3 centimeters long. They metastasize at 7.
How'd they find it?
Maybe this is my divine
mystical experience.
I was having what I described as mid-level back pain, just a discomfort. It didn't hurt. And it was on my left side. It was just the discomfort. And I knew it hadn't been there, but now it was there. So I went and saw my doctor and I described it to him. And you have to understand, my doctor was one of the Mavs maniacs, you know, the big fat guys that do the dance. Okay, well, he was one of them. His nickname was Doc. And he rode a Harley and he played the drums. He's the only doctor I've ever gone into the doctor's office and over the speakers, they're playing AC/DC. I mean, it's that kind of doctor,
love
right?
That.
Yeah. And so I told him what was going on and he said, you move any furniture lately? And I said, no, not really. I've been mowing the lawn, just, you know, lift the mower up or whatever. I said, no. And he said, well, it's probably just muscular. Go away for 30 days. If it's still bothering you in a month, then come back and we'll talk. So about 2 weeks later, I just thought, it's not getting any better. I know what my body's supposed to feel like.
Yeah.
So I made an appointment. I went back And he walked into the patient room and I was sitting there and he goes, what are you doing here? And I said, doc, my back's not right. Something's not right. And he goes, well, Randy, if you'd have waited 30 days like I told you to, and it was still bothering you, I would order a CT for you to see what was going on in there. Is that, would that make you feel better, doc? But Randy, was that, is that what I want you to do? And I said, yeah, I think that's what I want you to do. So I had the CT,
CAT scan.
CAT scan. Yeah, sorry, CT. I had this CAT scan right? done.
Yeah.
Yeah, with and without iodine. And his office called, my doctor's office called about 3 days later and said, Mr. Thompson, Dr. Smith wants to see you in his office. And I said, why? And she said, well, your CT results are in. And I said, well, just put them on the phone. And I'll never forget this. She goes, Dr. Smith doesn't have these conversations over the phone. And I thought, oh no.
Oh my God.
Oh no. So I went in and that's when he pulled up this, you have renal cell carcinoma. So the other charity that I give to is the National Kidney Foundation. And mostly because I didn't need them. There are a lot of people who need them and I didn't. My cancer was still a stage one. In fact, what he later said, I don't know that what you were feeling was actually this cancer. He said, I don't know that that was the case. He said, it didn't seem to me like it could. But somebody was tapping me on the shoulder and saying, something's going on, you need to go take care of it. And we did, and I got it taken out, and I didn't lose the kidney. The doctor said my tumor was hanging kind of like a wasp nest off of one end of my kidney on this right side. And my doctor, who hadn't been in medical school for probably 30 years, he said, Randy, you got to understand, you're in for the battle of your life. They're going to open up your back. You're going to open up your ribs. You got to go in and blah, 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 and all. They didn't do any of that. I have three little slits on my stomach where they put three cameras. And then another little slit where they put the thing to take the tumor out, and that was all there was to it. So if you're going to get cancer, getting one that they can just take out and you're done, I don't recommend it, obviously, but I'm now no more likely than any, what the doc told me is I'm no more likely than any other male over 50 to have another reoccurrence of this. I've had four CTs since, all have been clear. I now get a CT every 3 years as opposed to every 6 months, which is what happened after I started. So those wow. are the two.
That's amazing to hear.
Yeah, I feel like I get very lucky.
No doubt. How scary that must have been.
It was terrifying, especially yes. when he was describing what he thought was going to happen.
I have a question.
Yeah.
If you can live to be however old you want to be, how old would you pick? that might be a new podcast question.
It is. It's a very real one that people are going to have to grapple with. I don't think I'll have to grapple with it. I will tell you this. I will be 65 in July. I still feel 15. I still think like a 15-year-old. And I would tell you, as long as I am able to maintain that mentality, I don't really care how physically old I get. I know I'm not 15 when I look in a mirror and I'm like, yikes, what happened? But I inside, I still like feel like I have that same youthful energy I had when I was a 15-year-old. I still love learning new things and exploring and going new places and having new experiences and being engaged in life. And as long as I'm able to do that, I don't want to dodge your question, but I think that's how I'm going to answer it is I think as long as I'm comfortable and feel like I've got my faculties and I'm able to contribute to life in one way or the other, whether it's professionally or as a mentor or as a writer or as just a father, I'll do that. I guess so long as I remain feeling like I'm 15 with a lot of energy, I'm good.
Yeah. That's a strange thing to think about. I want to go read that book. I'm going to have to order it when we're done.
It's equal parts chilling and encouraging because of the implications of some of what's coming.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know if we as a society are ready for it. I hope we are, but I am just not sure.
Yeah. If you had $100 million in a briefcase, what would you invest it in? If you had to pick one thing.
Oh, can I... I'm going to answer that in an A and a B since I can only do one.
Yeah. Everybody has trouble picking one thing.
If it's strictly from an investment perspective, if I want to make sure that my money is going to do me the most good from a financial perspective, I'd buy land. And the reason is because God ain't making any more of it. Once it's done, it's done.
It's a Mark Twain quote, by the way.
Yeah, I know it is. And it's a brilliant quote and he's absolutely right. And it's still true, even in his day when there was still a lot more available land than there is today. That's if I was making strictly a financial decisions, that's what I would do. If I was thinking more philanthropically and how I would have the most impact on society, I actually wrote a book about this. I think it was my 11th book. I would use that money to create a charity that would bring an education to otherwise in children who would not have an opportunity for an education. And I don't mean create a series of charter schools. I mean kids who are in third world countries who have the intellectual capacity of any other child anywhere in the world, but they'll never have access to exercise that. So this book that I wrote did exactly that. It the story behind it was governments around the world had come together and created essentially an IQ platform where they would test children from developing countries and find the ones that had high academic achievement possibilities. They weren't achieving it yet because they weren't being educated, but they had a high achievement opportunity. They would then pluck those children out and teach them, put them in education facilities. But because what I write are mysteries and thrillers, there was a very dark underbelly going on behind all of that was quite disturbing at times as I was doing my research on how to write that subject. But that was what the story was about. So that's what I would do. I would try to use that money to bring kids with great potential out of bad situations and get them to achieve what is possible given their intellectual capacity. So that's what I do.
Love that. What's the number one thing on your bucket list or vision board that you're looking to knock out this year?
Yeah, given what we've talked about, it shouldn't come as any surprise, but I want to have one of my works of fiction published. I want to go on a world book tour. I want to have my book made into a movie produced by Taylor Sheridan. And then I want to have Chris Pine star in it.
Who's Taylor Sheridan?
He's the guy who does Yellowstone.
Oh, and yeah.
Hell
or
High Water.
Yeah, yeah.
And then Chris Pine will star in the role. And then my son Jesse is going to write the musical score. So those are the four: publish a book, world tour, movie, Chris Pine, and musical score. So not much really.
It's all happening. I feel it.
I'm feeling it too. That's 2024 in a nutshell.
I feel it, baby. if you express your clear intention on a podcast, it goes up 99%.
Let's hope. I'm all for that.
So everybody is rooting for you, Randy Thompson. Thank you for joining me here in my brand new Trucking On studio.
Love it.
You're the inaugural guest to be here. So hopefully it sounds good and looks good to our listeners out there. And if they want to track you down, where do they find you?
So a couple ways. If you want to talk to me about work-related stuff, I'm at randy.thompson@ryancompanies.com. Feel free to shoot me an email. We can talk about business, or we can talk about any of the other things that we've spoken about this morning, anything that interests you. If you want to look at my website is www.randall, R-A-N-D-A-L-L-D, and then St. Clair is S-T-C-L-A-I-R-E. So Randall D. St. Clair, all one string, that's the WebEx. My X count is S-T, so Saint S-T underscore Randall, R-A-N-D-A-L-L, 30930. And then my Facebook is Randall D. St. Clair. So those are the four ways that you can get a hold of me. I would love to have some of you go to my website, take a look at it, read the content, and then shoot me a note and let me know what you think. Because I built it, I can edit it, and if there's things that you think would be a good ad, I'm all ears, I'm open to hearing. So those are the four ways to reach me.
Amazing. Thank you so much, my brother.
Thank you, Ward. Appreciate you having me.
Thanks, everybody, for tuning in to this episode of Truckin' On. I hope you enjoyed it. If you did, don't be shy. Please like, share, leave a 5-star review so that we can keep doing what we're doing. Stay safe out there on the road. Keep on trucking.
So much shame when I share my little lies. No one left to blame until I stare into these eyes. I'm gonna tell the truth to you till I break on through to the other side. Living like I'm gonna die is the only time I feel alive. Living like I'm gonna die is the only time I feel alive. And I'm trucking on. I'm trucking on. Move on down the line. Another town will do me fine. I'm trucking on. I'm trucking on. And I'm trucking on.